Spiritual values are too subtle to be revealed by physical appearances. They can only be represented by the abstract form.
Every once in a while, there's an exhibition that blows up and becomes something greater than the sum of its parts. In the spring of 2019, I made a special trip to the Guggenheim in New York to see Hilma af Klint, Paintings for the Future. Seemingly overnight, this obscure Swedish artist, who died in 1944 at the age of 81, was an art world celebrity. Her big, beautiful, century-old paintings were suddenly ubiquitous on social media. But why? On a purely aesthetic level, the work is hard to deny, but this is not why the frenzy occurred. Her decidedly abstract paintings are inextricably linked to a certain spiritualism and search for meaning that struck a chord in complicated times. It wasn't about what these paintings looked like. It was about what they felt like, what they were attempting to convey, the questions they were asking, or perhaps even attempting to answer. In 1938, just 6 years before Hilma af Klint's death, a group of artists in New Mexico were joining together to grapple with similar issues. They called themselves the Transcendental Painting Group. According to their manifesto, the group wanted to, quote, carry painting beyond the appearance of the physical world through new concepts of space, color, light, and design to imaginative realms that are idealistic and spiritual, end quote. On today's episode, we chat with Philbrook curator Susan Green about the special exhibition Another World, the first comprehensive traveling exhibition to explore work by the Transcendental Painting Group. It's on view at Philbrook through February 20th. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. There are lots of artists that get put into groups after the fact, or you notice that there was a scene that was created. This, however, was quite purposeful. It was a group that was created not after the fact. So talk about the group and how they began.
Absolutely. It was almost like a club. They were kind of centered in New Mexico. Some of the artists already knew each other. Some of the artists were students of, there were two main artists, Emil Bistrom and Raymond Johnson. And so they had students who were, that they were working with and kind of tutoring and helping make their own careers. But then there were also other artists like Lauren Harris, who was just traveling across the country and happened to be in New Mexico and happened to meet one of the artists on the street. And they said, hey, come to this meeting. Let's talk about art. Let's talk about what our goals for art are. And they knew, they saw that, of course, New Mexico is tons of artists working in many different styles. And these specific artists were working abstractly. So they were using shape and form and color in other ways. And they realized that there was something different about abstraction. So with realistic painting, you show what you see. You see a still life and you paint it. You see a landscape and you paint it. But they were thinking about what else is there out in the world or in our consciousness. And so how do we paint something that's bigger than humanity, bigger than us as humans? How do we paint God, or how do we paint feelings, or how do we paint our relationship between each other? And they thought abstraction was the thing. Mm. So these artists all agreed on abstraction, and they agreed on this sort of higher purpose of abstraction, potential of abstraction. And so they essentially formed a group, formed a club. And it, part of it was totally practical. If you are a group of artists working together at a, with a common goal, you can promote your work for shows and to galleries and to buyers, potential buyers. You can get more newspaper articles written about you. So there is this strength in numbers. but there's also this strength in being able to work out ideas with each other.
And ideas are a big part of this whole endeavor. You know, you talk about abstraction. It wasn't just abstraction in the terms of what you see on the canvas. It was abstract ideas. You know, in some ways, it's like, what does it all mean?
Yeah.
What's the meaning of this and that or the other thing?
Yeah.
Trying to find purpose,
absolutely.
But using painting to try to explore those things, right?
Absolutely. So one of the artists, the youngest artist in the group, actually, she said that spiritual values are too subtle to be revealed by physical appearances. They can only be represented by the abstract form. So that spiritual value, that understanding of this other world, another world, the title of the show. So it's too tenuous to be represented in this sort of realism or realistic form. You have to go for the abstract.
Almost like, the, you know, in some religions, like the name of God is abstract, right?
Absolutely.
It can't be spoken.
You can't write it out. There is no, you can't define the name of God.
Yeah. And so in this, you know, this certain ideas transcend, for lack of a better term, any kind of real definition or anything like that. So New Mexico. Let's talk about New Mexico.
Okay.
I mean, I've spent time in Mexico. Mm-hmm. You've spent time in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a person that doesn't understand why people think it's an amazing place. It's
gorgeous. The sky, the land. The sky just sweeps over you. And the landscape changes. It's not just one
yeah, there's snow.
Terrain.
There's mountains.
Yeah.
There's desert. There's, you know, all of those things. It might be too simple of a question, but, you know, you talked about Emil Bistrom and Raymond Johnson, the kind of two co-founders of this group. How did it end up being there as opposed to Arizona or Utah or California or anywhere else?
Well, one of the things I think is fascinating is that nearly all of the artists associated with this group came from somewhere else. So they came from New York and they came from Chicago and from Kentucky or D.C. They came from other places, but they kind of – and Canada. Lauren Harris was from Canada. They came to New Mexico. Some of them came because it was sort of an artist colony. There were the Taos artists, the Santa Fe artists. There were already people kind of moving to New Mexico. They considered it this different type of place. The Pueblo culture is so prominent. But there were other artists that came because of health reasons. It was a place that doctors sent you if you had poor lungs. And just traveling the world. You know, Lauren Harris is just traveling across the U.S. So it's a combination of factors. But each of the artists, or nearly all of the artists, wrote something about why they stayed in New Mexico. And a lot of it is this kind of the idea of the sweeping landscape, the sky, the colors of the land. But also I think it was because they found their group. And it was this group in the middle of the country, not on the East Coast or West Coast. It was in the middle of the country. And so they had a little bit of freedom, I think, to play with ideas and to develop something stronger as this small group.
I was thinking about that in terms of this kind of chicken or the egg concept, which is so much of the work is obviously inspired by the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
But did the ideas that we talked about before that they brought into the group predate the place? Did they already kind of know the things they wanted to do before they got to New Mexico? Or was it like, I got here and then the ideas started to form?
Oh, it's an amazing question. So I think there is a little bit of chicken egg issue. Some of them were already contemplating these ideas. I mean, going back to Lauren Harris, he's the one from Canada. He was interested in this new way of thinking, something called theosophy. So the idea of there's something more in the universe that we can search to find it, and then somehow we can depict it in this sort of abstract way. There were other artists in Europe like Kandinsky and Mondrian who were interested in theosophy, and they wrote books which then sort of made their way to the U.S., and these artists read them, 50 years later. So there were artists already interested in this kind of combination of spirituality and abstraction. So Lauren Harris, Emil Bistrom, definitely Raymond Johnson, and then their students also. So they are sort of steeped in this idea of how can we represent this something more, this another world. but they find themselves in a place that is open to those ideas and maybe has a little bit of a different, calmer lifestyle than New York or LA or Chicago.
So a few years back, we interviewed the curator at the Guggenheim for their big kind of blockbuster show they did on Hilma off Klint, which was a show of abstraction by an artist who was very much not known by the public but became a cause celeb. And and one of the reasons was because of the overlap of spiritualism and these kind of headier ideas within these big, beautiful abstract paintings. And it seems like that sparked something, that there's an interest. These tackle some similar pursuits.
Yes.
Why do you think people are interested in the spiritual side of art?
Well, I think that right now there is a moment, or maybe the last 5 years, 10 years, there's a moment that we are looking inward and we're looking across the table, like you and I. What are our relationships? How can we depict those relationships? What is that more? And artists like Hilma af Klint, she was creating this world of abstraction. She was depicting sort of a one-to-one. This is a symbol for this, and this is a symbol for the attainment of this step. And so there's very much a kind of an iconography in her work. And so there's something to grasp, something bigger than us. And I think we're looking for something bigger now. We're looking for this idea of what is humanity and what's our relationship to each other. One of the things I think is really interesting about this group is that there were multiple artists associated with it, but each artist approached this idea of depicting spirituality in a different way. So there was not one answer, not one way to depict the divine or the sky or love or music or anything. Every artist picked a different form, and some of them are very symbolic. Emil Bistrom says this line means this and this color means this, while others really seem to feel their way in the canvas. And so I think that also opens up interactions with visitors. Each person is going to find something to immerse themselves in these works. Each work of art is completely different style. Some are very hard-edged. Some are very almost floral. Some are, you know, reds and purples, and some are very soft pastels. But each person will find something different. And so that kind of openness of who we are all, we don't want to be pigeonholed. We don't want to, you know, there's a spectrum of life and a spectrum of understanding of our humanity. So why isn't there a spectrum of artworks that we can immerse ourselves into? And so I kind of feel that in these works, and Hilma af Klint is, some of the works are huge, and you really do feel like you can walk into them, but there's only the one style, the one form. And so here there are multiple.
Radical ideas are tamed by time, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think one of the things that I think is hardest to relay about a lot of abstract art generally is how new it felt at the time.
Totally.
And I think we become so used to it, it becomes cliche, or it becomes just something we've seen before, or you see this lineage of people who took some idea.
Mm-hmm.
But to truly see something in the moment that's unlike anything before is very powerful. And a lot of these kind of works were so new at the time. As a curator, I'm just curious, how do you relay that?
It's
is
so
it possible
hard. I don't
relay
know
that?
If it's
to kind of say, hey, at the time, this was radical.
Yeah, you know? I don't know if you can relay that. That power of seeing reds and greens together with no comprehensible association. I don't know if there really is a way. You can sort of suspend belief. You can kind of ask someone to put their understanding behind them. I mean, you can ask someone to step back in time, but they'll never really be able to do it. We also tried a little bit to give a little bit of a context that this is sort of the period between the wars. It's during the Great Depression. These other things are going on, so you can kind of get a glimpse into what the world might have been like.
Mm.
And at that time, there was a lot of uncertainty. So World War I had ended. One of the artists actually lied about his age and participated in World War I and had injuries that followed him the rest of his life, and he died at an early age. And all of these artists would have known people who had been in the trenches or had trauma from the war. then they're living in the Great Depression, in the middle of a state which was affected by the Dust Bowl. And then they can see through news reports what's happening in Europe as well. So the buildup to World War II. So there's a lot of uncertainty in the world, and I think that also is a connection to our time today. There's a lot of uncertainty. Where are we going? Who are we? Can we make the world a better place? Can we actually save the world with climate change? Is there a future for the world? So that uncertainty, and that also, I think, makes us strive for understanding each other and the striving for this understanding of something that could be bigger than us.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Stendhal Syndrome. Have you ever seen a work of art so powerful it moved you to tears? Well, guess what? There is a name for that. Stendhal Syndrome is a psychosomatic condition involving rapid heartbeat, fainting, confusion, and sometimes even hallucinations, allegedly occurring when individuals become exposed to objects, artworks, or phenomena of great and moving beauty. For more on Stendhal Syndrome, please visit allthefeels.org. And by the way, that's feels with a Z.
So the idea of something like World War I, which was so ubiquitous in terms of experience and people having personal connections to that, mm-hmm. it's hard to find too many things like that in the world. I mean, something like even 9/11, for example, most people didn't personally know someone who died in those things, even though it was one of the biggest tragedies of the century. But also, all those people in World War I probably all knew someone who died of the Spanish flu.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And so that does bring us into this moment where you look at something like the COVID-19 pandemic and you think, by the time we're on the other side of this, all of us will have been touched by it in one way or another, whether personally sick or certainly known people that were either sick, passed away, and all those things. And the collective impact of a trauma like that, we don't know how that will impact expression, art, film, music, but it certainly will.
Absolutely.
Everything, you know. We don't see that yet. This stuff is happening 15 years, 20 years after the fact of, you know, World War I. And it took that time for people to start processing some of those things. It wasn't as if, you know, a year after the thing, people were sorted out their how they felt about things. But we're seeking, you know. I look at these people and I think they're seekers, right? They're seeking something. And you brought up earlier the fact that people respond to this because we're still generally seeking things.
Yeah, I think we're seeking. And there's the decline in sort of organized religion, but that doesn't mean that people aren't seeking whatever that higher truth for them might be. And something else that I like about this exhibition is that there is no right or wrong answer. Again, every artist approaches it differently.
Because this was not particularly dogmatic.
No,
it wasn't,
not at all.
It wasn't denominational in any way.
No, not at all. So the artists came from all different backgrounds, primarily Christian, of course. This is the U.S. in the 20s and 30s and 40s. But there is one artist who is a practicing Zen Buddhist. There's artists who are still very much, there's artists who still affiliate themselves with the Christian religion, but there are also artists who have decided they are atheist or agnostic. And many of the artists don't necessarily, you know, state one way or the other. But there is this continual looking for something else, something bigger, in whatever way they want to define it. And so I think that there is something for us to see in the works, too, as we're searching in whatever way we might be.
So I'd like to wrap up by talking about the fact that this group was mostly dominated by white men. But there was a woman.
Two women
artists in the group, but one woman specifically who has kind of, in some ways, become the most known of the group and transcended.
Absolutely.
To use that again. That's Agnes Pelton. Agnes Pelton is an artist who has had a lot of recent looks at her work and more critical writings done and kind of a reappraisal of who was she and what was her role in this group.
She's fascinating and wonderful, and her work really does shine in this exhibition. we're able to bring together a whole grouping of her work. And there's both a section that is only her work, and then she's also sprinkled throughout. So there's little, you can find the joy in her work throughout the exhibition. She was this fascinating woman who, again, grew up in a very religious household, was very close to her mother, her family. And she became an artist, was working in New York, and needed to get away. She got away to Long Island for a while, lived in a windmill. But then, and she visited New Mexico, but she ended up in California, in sort of in the desert area. And she saw, again, had this connection with the landscape, with light, and with this sort of inner searching. And so she, to make a living, she painted sort of almost like you might consider tourist art. You know, someone comes through the area, and she had these beautiful paintings of sagebrush and mountains and desert. But for herself, she painted these vibrant, immersive abstractions. And they truly glow. They're lush. And she saw this life in the light in the landscape. She said that she would go for walks at morning and at dusk. And seeing how that light changed and changed the color and changed the feeling of the landscape. And then she somehow imbues these abstractions, these beautiful abstractions, with this light and this kind of love and this yearning as well. They're truly gorgeous. And, you know, curators don't say that very often, but they truly are gorgeous.
A lot of people, I think, make the silly assumption that Agnes Pelton is kind of looking at Georgia O'Keeffe and trying some of the same things, you know, but these are people doing different things in different places.
Absolutely. She was working a little bit earlier than Georgia O'Keeffe. She was in the Armory Show, which was sort of a highlight of abstraction, bringing abstraction to the
this
U.S.
This is like 1914.
Yeah. And she is sort of playing with these ideas so early. And the artists in the Transcendental Painting Group actually invited her to participate, even though she wasn't living in New Mexico. She's the only one who's not living in New Mexico, because they saw her, they admired her work so much. They saw her as sort of a trailblazer in connecting abstraction and spirituality. They knew her work. They really venerated her. She was the oldest of the artists. And so she was working in that way before Georgia O'Keeffe was. And there is this, because Georgia O'Keeffe is also working in New Mexico in kind of the same area, there is this sort of connection. And there's these big, beautiful, sinuous forms and the sweeping color. So there is a connection. But Agnes Pelton, again, is earlier. And it's a little more personal. It's a little more sort of insightful. And you feel that it's a piece of her soul rather than her vision of the world, although it is her vision of the world, too.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a kind of they're poetic in a certain way.
Very poetic. You know? This is an unattributable quote, but someone said
that's
that
our favorite kind.
I know it's totally our favorite. Someone said that Georgia O'Keeffe paints what a flower looks like, and Agnes Pelton paints what a flower feels like. So there's this kind of difference, although that is an arguable statement. But there is definitely this feeling of an inner life in Agnes Pelton's work.
And, you know, feeling is important. I mean, we were, when we were kind of early on trying to think, like, how are we going to talk about this show? Mm-hmm. We kept saying, like, all the feels, you know, we were talking about all the feels, how we can make people understand what this show is about. Just to wrap up, I'm curious what it's been like for you to do this show. And was this work you were familiar with to begin with? Do you have a new appreciation for it? How does working with a body of work like this change your relationship to it?
Well, I definitely have a new relationship with it. I did know Agnes Pelton's work and Emil Bystrom and Raymond Jones and some sort of these standout artists of the group. But there were artists I had never heard of before. I had never heard of Florence Miller Pierce, who's the other woman, who's the youngest of the artists, although she goes on to have an incredible career, really working almost a minimalist artist. But I'm very interested in how artists and how we depict what is more, that spirituality, again, the relationships between us as humans. And so seeing that glimmer in each of these paintings has been fascinating for me. Horace Towner Pierce is another artist I didn't know about, and his almost mathematical abstractions are gorgeous, and looking at the surface and how he applies the art, and they seem so almost staid in a reproduction, but in person, they just, you want to touch them. They're so tactile. So I've both absolutely immersed myself in this group and learning about each of the artists individually and then how they're making, trying to make a difference as a whole, and then how they go on, because the group only existed for a few years, but each of the artists continues in their career. I love finding these groups of artists, and I'm looking forward to sort of discovering the next group of artists who might be doing the same thing, and maybe they're the artists who are working today, just as you pointed out, how they're dealing with our contemporary issues and moving forward.
In 1872, Agnes Pelton's grandmother, Elizabeth Tilton, was publicly outed as, quote, living in concubinage with renowned minister and abolitionist Henry Ward Beecher. The affair resulted in a Brooklyn-based adultery trial that started on January 11, 1875, and lasted for 6 months. In the wake of this scandal, Agnes's mother Florence was shipped off to Germany, where she later married Louisiana expat William Pelton. Agnes was born in Stuttgart in 1881. The term dysfunctional family wasn't fully defined until 1974, but Agnes was well aware of her situation. From the time of puberty, she recalled, I was much inclined to melancholy and tears, which was probably aggravated by being the only child in a household of deeply religious and perhaps unnecessarily serious people. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.